Okay. Sihan?
Yes, Sihan.
If you don't mind first names.
No, that's
fine. So I'm Kim Schaefer, and I have a colleague connected by phone, Melanie Vickers. We're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. It is a congressionally established, independent, bipartisan commission that was charged with investigating the causes of the financial crisis and preparing a holding some hearings and preparing a report to Congress and the President, and for that matter, the American people, of what occurred and why, and also to investigate what happened with a variety of institutions that failed or would have failed but for government support. I have no reason to believe that you would say anything that's inaccurate, but you should know that because we're the federal government, that were you to state something that is inaccurate, that would be a criminal offense. I will try in my questions to, when I'm asking your opinion, to ask to state that I'm asking your opinion, therefore, presumably, unless you have a different opinion from what you state, presumably there's no right or wrong answer, and it's just your opinion.
Yeah.
And if I keep going when you want to take a break, I tend to do that. Please feel free. Just by brief way of background, I actually have a background in structured products, but this record, it will be part of the archives, and even if I understand something, I occasionally will try to restate it just so that we have an accurate record for perhaps people who are less technically sophisticated to understand, and I probably don't do that. So, for the record, would you kindly first just give us your professional background after college?
Sure, yeah. I graduated from Dartmouth College in 2004. After that, I joined Lehman Brothers. I worked at Lehman as a research analyst. I worked at the ABS, asset-backed securities strategy desk, and we cover asset-backed securities including credit card ABS, auto ABS, student loan ABS, and home equity loans, which is also subprime mortgage-backed securities. I was responsible for writing research reports on a weekly basis, assisting the trading desk with different types of trading projects, and also talking with clients in terms of market outlook and also our research. I worked at Lehman for a year and 9 months. I joined Paulson & Company in March 2006 as a mortgage research analyst, and now I run the mortgage research at Paulson. I am the head of structured product research at Paulson, and we cover mostly RMBS and CMBS.
And how did it come to pass that you came to Paulson & Company?
Paolo Pellegrini, who used to work at Paulson, contacted me when I was at Lehman. He asked me to come to Paulson to do an interview with John and Paolo. They read about my research. That's how they contacted me.
I apologize. I mean no disrespect by asking this question. Actually, Stuart, sorry, we didn't go around the room. I have my list of questions, and so I let me back up for a minute. If everyone who's in the room from your side could state their name for the record.
Stuart Merzer.
M-E-R-Z-E-R,
General Counsel of Paulson & Company.
Maylen Kwanget, it's K-W-A-N-G-E-T-T, Wilkie Farr & Gallagher.
Rita Mitchell, Wilkie Farndowder.
Thank you. So I think the initial request was actually to interview John Paulson, and you were suggested instead. I mean, no disrespect by asking, but of a variety of people who were involved in the key mortgage business and trades. Why? And if you want to answer this question, said Stuart, why was Sihan suggested to talk to us instead of others?
Well, Sihan is very familiar with this area, particularly, and what happened at our investment strategy at our firm.
Yes, and Sihan, as he told you, had been at Lehman Brothers really focused on the mortgage market, and particularly asset-backed securities. And it was around the same time that folks at Paulson were really developing their strategy and thinking about how they thought trends were going to go. And so part of why Sihan was brought on was because they felt that his outlook and his view of the market was very similar and in tune with how they were already viewing the market. And so he was brought on, and he and Paolo Pellegrini, who Sihan mentioned, and John really worked together to develop the Paulson & Company strategy for, you know, how to go forward given what they thought was going to happen with the market. And so when we saw your request to talk with John Paulson about the views on the financial crisis, really most of Paulson & Company's views towards the financial crisis in terms of how it affected their own, you know, business strategy and model are related to the credit area, and particularly the, you know, mortgage research. And as Sihan noted, he's the head of mortgage research for them. So he really, I thought, was the person who could give you nuts and bolts to the extent you wanted to go into more technicalities about how they went about building their research and making their trading decisions. Of course, the decisions themselves were more, you know, collaborative, and yes, John Paulson was you know, the one who ultimately makes those decisions, but Sihan's really sort of the person who could not only talk about the big picture but also the nitty-gritty underneath that if you wanted to get to that level.
Thank you. I expected that to be the answer, and actually why I was quite happy to do this interview and perhaps save Mr. Paulson some time and get into the nitty-gritty, but I thought we should, I thought I needed to ask that question and have it as part of the record. Okay. So could you start then by talking about some of your mortgage research while you were at Lehman and what, you know, what you were finding, what you were thinking, sort of taking us back to, you joined Lehman in 2004?
In summer 2004, yeah. So when I first joined Lehman, subprime mortgage-backed securities were quite popular. There was huge demand for this type of securities. But it's still relatively new to a lot of investors. So when I first joined Lehman, we actually spent a lot of time to educate investors about subprime mortgage-backed securities, their characteristics and structure, and also collateral performance. So one of the first projects I was involved while I was at Lehman was to write a primer on subprime mortgage-backed securities. And later on in 2005, I think a lot of investors got concerned about the housing market, what's going to happen to mortgage-backed security, to the performance of mortgage-backed securities, subprime mortgage-backed securities, if home prices started to decline instead of going at 12-15% every year. If it starts to go to 5% annualized home price appreciation, what's going to happen to the collateral performance? So we started, as a team, we started to look at home price subprime mortgage-backed securities performance under different home price scenarios. We did some research in August 2005, what we found out was that if home prices started to become flat or even go negative on a nationwide basis, a lot of these mortgage-backed securities could be at risk of downgrades, especially those securities at the bottom of the capital structure, the BBB, BBB minus securities. That's the research we did when we were at Lehman, and this research, I think you can still find them from Lehman's website.
Yes. Okay. When you arrived at Paulson & Co., had any shorts yet been put on?
Yes. Before I joined Paulson, John had already started. John became concerned about the credit market in general in 2005. And he got concerned with the housing market as well, and found out the subprime mortgage-backed securities could be a good way to hedge the general credit risk we have in other parts of the portfolio. As you know, Paulson & Company started as a merger and arbitrage firm, so we had a lot of exposure to company credit risk. So we had, John had already started to buy protection on a basket of subprime mortgage-backed securities back in 2005. Back in, I think, the first trade we did to buy protection on subprime mortgage-backed securities was in the summer of 2005. That's when the pay-as-you-go ABS CDS on subprime mortgage-backed securities was first developed. It was in the summer of 2005. Before that, there was no way you can buy protection or go short subprime mortgage-backed securities. It is until the summer of 2005 when we had the pay-as-you-go ABS CDS.
And you said he bought protection on a portfolio. Was this a portfolio?
On a basket of subprime mortgage-backed securities.
What's the difference between a basket and his picking individual names?
No, it's the same. It's basically we looked at a bunch of names and we picked some names to buy protection on those names. So.
Okay, it wasn't a prepackaged basket.
It's not.
Will.
No, it was just doing them all at the same time.
Right.
No
right.
Different than
exactly.
If you had bought them individually.
Right. Exactly.
That's a timing
yep.
issue.
Okay. Then you arrived, and were you or was Mr. Paulson becoming increasingly negative about the market? How did all of your views evolve?
Sure. After I arrived, we continued to monitor the development in the housing market. What we noticed were a few different things. First of all, home prices started to decline on a year-over-year basis. So home prices were still increasing, but it was increasing at a slower speed. As I mentioned earlier, back in 2004-2005, home prices were going up at double digit every year, 12-15% every year. But when you got to the summer of 2006, home prices were increasing about 1% based on existing median home price published by National Association of Realtors. That's the first thing we noticed.
Just to clarify. So you're saying they haven't yet declined, it's just that
the rate of increase has declined. Exactly. So
Thank
it's
you.
The derivative. The rate of increase of home price appreciation has already declined. The second thing we noticed was the performance has not, but that decline in increase in home price has not translated into deterioration in collateral performance. Performance was still hold up pretty well, but we would expect performance to start to deteriorate, given home prices are about to decline. And we also started to estimate what could be the collateral loss ratio for these mortgage-backed securities, subprime mortgage-backed securities, under different home price scenarios. Back in the summer of 2006, the loss ratio in subprime mortgage-backed securities was actually pretty low. It's about slightly less than 1%. It's about 83 basis points based on our estimate. But we estimate as home prices become flat, loss ratio would increase almost 10 times to about 7.1%. If home prices start to decline nationwide, if it becomes negative 5% annualized, the loss ratio could go to as much as 17%. So we started to increase our short exposure to the subprime mortgage market.
And did you continue to do that through single names, or were you then also going short using indices?
We actually we did a combination of both. We actually we employed three strategies in sourcing or going short the subprime mortgage market. The first instrument we used was single name CDS. The second instrument we used was ABX index. And the third one was ABS CDOs, mezzanine ABS CDOs. Mezzanine ABS CDOs was backed by subprime mortgage backed securities, mostly rated as BBB and BBB-.
So for the ABS CDOs, technically you would you would sell protection
the other way around. They would buy protection.
You would buy protection on the CDO.
That's right.
And on the triple B tranches, so is CDS and CDS. And
well, it was more that the CDOs were based on the triple B tranche of the RMBS.
The underlying collateral of ABS CDO is triple B rated subprime RMBS.
Yeah, okay. So on mezzanine ABS CDOs, and which tranches of CDOs would you short?
We bought protection on super senior AAA, senior AAA, junior AAA, and double A tranches of mezzanine ABS CDOs.
And did you do that on cash or synthetic CDOs? Did it matter to you?
All the trades we've done is in synthetic format. So some of these CDOs could be cash CDOs, but we bought protection. So we enter into a CDS contract. The reference obligation is going to be this cash CDO. Some other CDOs are synthetic CDOs, so we bought protection directly on the CDO.
Okay. And how did you choose one strategy over the other, and did that change over time?
Sure. There are pros and cons in different strategies. We like ABX index because it offers the most liquidity. We get price quotes from all the major broker-dealers on a daily basis. It's fairly liquid. We can buy protection in size. Valuation is really transparent. But the problem with ABX index is just you have to buy the entire index. sort of like you have to buy the entire S&P 500 index. But we kind of like to do our own credit work to pick some subprime mortgage-backed securities we believe are going to underperform other securities. So we'd like to do our own credit work to pick out those securities. That's why we kind of like single-name CDS. We can do our own credit work to look at the underlying mortgage collateral, to look at deal structure and pick names we'd like to buy protection on. And for ABS CDOs, it's just we figured the ABS CDO is also pretty attractive to buy protection on because the rating agencies have given too much credit to diversification. These subprime mortgage-backed securities themselves are already diversified. In a typical subprime mortgage-backed security, you're going to have 30% mortgage borrowers in California, 10% in Florida, 10% in New York. When you do an ABS CDO, you're going to have 100 of those subprime deals together, but still it's going to be 30% borrowers in California, 10% in Florida, 10% in New York. To us, there is not so much diversification in ABS CDO. And if you buy protection on the BBB or even AA tranche of the ABS CDO, the price is pretty attractive. So from a risk-reward standpoint, it's also pretty attractive to do ABS CDOs. So we did a combination of all of these.
Okay.
All right,
mind if I jump in, Kim, or should I jump in?
Please.
I wonder if you can set the scene for us a little bit, tell us about what your rules of thumb would be. I mean, you were shorting this stuff, so presumably you were looking for the ones that would be the worst performers. Am I right on that?
That's correct.
Okay, so maybe you can explain, what would be a pretty good brand of lousy CDO?
You know, every CDO is different. I think you really have to do the credit work because every CDO is going to have 100 of sometimes even more than 100 subprime mortgage-backed securities. So you really have to be able to analyze all these 100 subprime mortgage-backed securities, and then you put them at the aggregate level to look at what is going to be the loss ratio for the CDO and whether the loss ratio is going to be high enough to impair the tranches we'd like to buy protection on. So there is no rule of thumb we can use. It's really a detailed credit analysis we have to do to look at all these 100 subprime mortgage-backed securities to look at what is the underlying mortgage collateral, what's the underlying borrower characteristics.
We'll see how.
Okay, I get that, but presumably you had some areas that you knew were good signs. Were they, for example, geographical, or were certain originators particularly useful? That's the kind of thing I'm looking for.
Sure, yeah. We focused on those bubble areas. As you probably know, the four bubble areas in the country are California, Nevada, Arizona, and Florida. So we like securities with a high concentration in these bubble areas. We are concerned about these hybrid mortgages because back then the hybrid mortgages have a teaser rate of 6.5 to 7%, but the fully indexed rate is LIBOR plus 600 basis points, and LIBOR was 5% back in 2006, which means if LIBOR stayed the same, these borrowers will have a payment shock from 7% to 11% in 2 years. Most of these hybrid subprime mortgages are 228. So we like mortgage-backed securities with a high hybrid ARM percentage. And also a lot of these mortgage-backed securities have limited documentation. On average, 40% of the subprime mortgage borrowers have limited documentation or no documentation. So when we buy protection, we'd like to buy protection on deals with high limited documentation or no documentation percentage.
Okay, thanks for that. Can you elaborate any in particular? Any state particularly good, or can you name some originators that were useful there?
Yes, sure. We also have done some work to look at originators and servicers. I think some originators are doing a better job than others. For example, Wells Fargo is a top servicer and originator. Most of the subprime mortgages they have done come with full documentation. And on the other hand, you have New Century, which is probably one of the worst mortgage originators out there.
So what would you, well, how much New Century would you have had back in 2000? And well, I don't know if you would have done this kind of work at Lehman, or was there, it was just at Paulson.
You mean how much exposure we have, how much protection we have bought on deals originated by New Century?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's all relative, because we're not the only one that know New Century was a relatively worse originator than others. So it's just a matter of pricing. The market has already priced in to this higher credit risk of loans originated by New Century. Even though we'd like to buy protection on New Century deals, but those deals tend to be more expensive. So it's all on a relative basis.
Thank you.
Actually, those comments and questions related more to mortgage-backed securities, and perhaps your answer with regard to CDOs was just you looked at the underlying portfolio,
exactly.
and that's really what you cared
yep.
about, but were there either managers or underwriters or any other characteristic of CDOs that you particularly looked at when you were
No, short. I think for ABS CDOs, the ABS CDOs we bought are mostly static ABS CDOs, so those are not managed ABS CDOs. There is no CDO manager in most of the CDOs we bought protection on, so we really haven't done work to look at the quality of CDO management. What we've done is really, as you said, just to look at underlying mortgage-backed securities, the underlying mortgage borrower characteristics and underlying performance of these mortgages, and also the CDO structure and also the underlying mortgage-backed security structure to identify deals we'd like to buy protection on.
And since these were static CDOs that you were shorting, were you and colleagues involved in reviewing and or suggesting names that would be the portfolio of the CDO?
Well, there are some CDOs we bought protection. Those CDOs have already been created, already trading in the secondary market. So we just we've done the analysis and we went to buy protection on those CDOs. There are cases we propose some names to their protection seller, and then we negotiate about what names to be included in the portfolio, and the protection seller decided to put in certain names, and then we buy protection on those CDOs.
In other words, in some cases, yeah, no, and in other cases, yes.
Yes.
Okay. Were there different times, you talked about in these three different strategies, or really three different mechanisms for going short, you talked about the advantages and disadvantages, but were there different times in the 2006-2007 time frame when one strategy was significantly more desirable than at another time? Did the relative mix of those strategies change over time?
No, I think the majority of what we have done is basically ABS CDO. The majority of the protection we have bought on were index ABS and also single name CDS, and we did a little bit ABS CDOs. The strategy was basically to use all three instruments that didn't really change. We didn't really shift our focus to one particular instrument.
Who did you buy CDSs from?
It's mostly, basically from all the major broker-dealers in the market.
Could you give some idea, like when would have been the first CDS that you bought from Goldman, and what did you want to know about it before you got into the deal?
We didn't buy, the first trade we did was not with Goldman. Or are you just talking about if we want to buy potential from Goldman, what information we would require from Goldman? I didn't understand the question.
The background of my question is Goldman did a lot of business, of course, you know, this, you know, with AIG on CDSs, and Goldman required the swap to have certain collateral provisions. And I'm wondering whether that's the kind of thing you would have looked at, you know, to ensure that you, you know, sort of an extra hedge in a way that you could get your money.
I didn't quite understand your question. You know, from our standpoint, we don't know who's on the other side of Goldman. If we buy protection, we face Goldman. And we don't know if Goldman's going to hedge their credit risk. And even if they do, we don't know who they're going to buy protection from. So from our standpoint, we don't know who Goldman is facing. And we don't really care who Goldman is facing because we are buying protection from Goldman.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, were there differences, say, between your the different CDS partners or counterparties?
Yeah, as I said, we have faced all the major broker-dealers on the street.
Okay.
Following up on that in a different way, comparing these three strategies, is the collateral, was your ability to obtain leverage different with three different strategies? And another way to ask that question is, were the collateral requirements that you were subject to different from the three different strategies?
Well, I don't think it's that different because we are the protection buyer. So in terms of our total payments, it's limited. You know, if home prices did not decline and all these mortgage-backed securities perform really well, then the bonds will be paid off in a few years. So we know how much is the credit protection premium we have to pay, and our counterparties also know. So in terms of collateral requirement, I don't know for sure, but I don't think there is a major difference between three different instruments.
So really the way to measure leverage in terms of your investing is the premium versus the notional amount.
AUM, yeah.
Okay. And when you went short ABX, that's tranched as well. So were there certain tranches that you liked?
We went short mostly BBB ABX index. We also went short some single A ABX index. But it's mostly BBB.
So, would you mind walking through? I will offer you that I did at least skim through the greatest trade ever, and that does go through the time series of putting on trades, being worried, are they really going to pan out, shifting things around, and then ultimately paying off. But would you mind doing a from your perspective, a sort of important milestones in the timeline of putting on the investments and watching how the shorts develop? Developed, materialized in terms of profits.
Really. Sure, yeah. So I can start. As I said, John had already started to buy potential and subprime mortgage-backed securities before I joined Paulson, but I can certainly talk about what happened after I joined Paulson. So I joined Paulson in March 2006, and since I joined Paulson, we continued to do analysis on the housing market and also on the performance of subprime mortgage-backed securities. We launched our credit opportunity fund, which initially was dedicated to this short subprime strategy in the summer of 2006, because at that time, as I mentioned earlier, we noticed even though the rate of increase home price appreciation has slowed down dramatically, it has not translated into any deterioration in the underlying collateral performance. So the credit premium you have to pay to buy potential and subprime mortgage-backed securities was pretty attractive, and we decided to launch this credit opportunity fund to take advantage of this market opportunity. And in February 2007, HSBC announced they had to increase their loss provisions by $10 billion to cover subprime losses. And shortly after that, New Century, the number two subprime originator in terms of origination volume, went bankrupt due to early payment default. And that has caused the mortgage-backed securities to sell off. The ABX index, BBB ABX 062, prices declined from par 100 to 80 cents on the dollar. That's a 20% decline.
Excuse me, was that February 07 as well?
That's February 07, yeah, February, March 07, in that period. And afterwards, the market sort of stabilized, prices recovered a little bit, but when it comes to July 2007, two Bear Stearns hedge funds went collapsed due to the leverage they took on the ABS CDO market. And the ABS CDO, they bought, I think, mostly are mezzanine ABS CDOs. That has caused another sell-off in subprime mortgage-backed securities and also in ABS CDOs. Rating agencies started to downgrade mortgage-backed securities, subprime mortgage-backed securities in October, November 2007. It's a large-scale downgrade. Hundreds of billions of these securities got downgraded by S&P, Moody's, and Fitch. And by the end of 2007, ABF's index dropped from par at the beginning of the year to 20 cents on the dollar. And the collateral performance.
That was the BBB?
That's the BBB ABF's 062 index.
Yes.
And collateral performance deteriorated significantly. The year-over-year change in delinquency rate increased 3 to 4 times. And home prices also started to decline. If you look at National Association of Realtors home price index, median existing home sales price, it has dropped about 15% from third quarter of 2005 to the end of 2007, prices dropped about 15% on a cumulative basis.
Sorry, from third quarter of 2005
to the end of 2007, home prices dropped about 15% from $231,000 to $204,000.
Looking at just that time frame and those developments, did anything surprise you?
You know, I think it's something we had expected when we did our analysis. We expected home prices would decline. It has gone up too much. On a cumulative basis, U.S. home prices has gone up about 70% from 2000 to 2001. If you look at, we actually did a chart to look at the real home price increase. From 1975 to 2000, home prices were increasing about 1.3 to 1.5% per year. That's real home price increase. And after 2000, home prices were increasing at about 6.5 to 7% every year. It was not sustainable, so we had expected home prices to decline. Origination underwriting standards were also deteriorating at that during that period. If you look at limited documentation mortgages, 100% financing mortgages, all these are going up. All these ratios were going up in that period. So it was not that surprising to us. Several originators went bankrupt during that period. And also there was a huge amount of leverage taken by financial institutions. So that has caused those two Bearstone hedge funds to fail.
Did you have a sense of who the other shorts were in the market, or who the other longs were in the market?
You know, we don't know for sure. I think it's just backing, as I mentioned earlier, back in 2004, 2005, subprime mortgage-backed securities were really popular. There was huge demand from money managers, insurance companies, foreign banks to buy these type of securities. It was an environment everyone was chasing yield. AAA subprime mortgage-backed securities was yielding about LIBOR plus 15 to 20 basis points. So everyone was chasing that 15 to 20 basis points. In terms of potential buyers, I think as performance started to deteriorate, a lot of investors realized the problem in the subprime mortgage market, the problem in the housing market, and they started to put on, started to hedge their risk, credit risk, and started to buy protection on subprime mortgage-backed securities. So at the beginning, you probably only had a few investors in this market buying protection, but as the market started to deteriorate, you had more and more investors to be involved.
Can you paint that picture a little more, like in a given year, you know, say start with your earliest inkling about trouble in the subprime market? You know, you were a minority of what, you know, 5% of the players, and then in 2005, you, what proportion of the players would you say knew, you
well,
know?
You know, the subprime CDS, whether it's ABFs or single name CDS, all these are trading over the counter. So there is no tracking system to know exactly what is the total outstanding subprime CDS. So I actually don't know exactly how many investors are involved in buying protection in the market and what is our percentage in the market. There is no way to find out.
Although you were saying things got more expensive.
Things got more?
You
or was
saying
that the
things
index?
Got more expensive.
Oh, yeah. It did get more expensive. As performance started to deteriorate, investors became more aware of the problems in the subprime market, in the housing market, and they started to buy protection. That's something we observed from protection premium you pay on these mortgage-backed securities. The protection premium started to increase gradually over time. It's the same as the ABF index. It was trading at par at the beginning of 2007, and it dropped to 80 cents on the dollar in March 2007, and then it continued to decline all the way to 20 cents on the dollar at the end of 2007. So the protection premium is the opposite of that, so it was increasing as prices declined.
What about previous years? Or can you not observe any of this before 2007?
2006, the market was relatively stable. Spreads did widen a little bit. Prices declined a little bit, but it's not that significant.
The prices on what?
ABS prices and also protection premium you pay on mortgage-backed securities, subprime mortgage-backed securities. ABS prices declined a little bit in 2006, but it's not significant.
Did you shop around for your swap to get different quotes?
Did we shop around for our swaps?
Do you want to talk about how the single name CDS market worked?
Yeah, the way, let me first explain how the market works. For ABS, you basically have price quotes from all the dealers throughout the day. They send out price quotes. For single name CDS, the way it usually works is we would send out an OWIC. It's called Offer Wanted in Competition, which means we want to buy protection on certain names. So we send out a list. It's kind of like an auction process. And then we would get back the list in a few hours. We set the time. We say we want the list back at, we send it out at 10 o'clock. We want the list back at 3 o'clock. So in 5 hours, we will get the names back. We will get the list back. All the dealers, most of the dealers we send this to will participate. They will put a spread next to these names. This is the spread they will charge us to buy protection. So dealer A might charge us 105 basis points to buy protection on this particular security. Dealer B might charge us 100 basis points. Then we will all go with dealer B, buy protection from dealer B to pay 100 basis points.
So that's fascinating. You have that back to 2000 and what would be the first year when you had those? I mean, these, as you were saying, these price points are very hard to find, and it would be interesting to see what the trend was there going back as far as you can.
That's right. I think it's CDS is trading over the counter, and it's difficult to track on one particular security because sometimes it's going to trade, sometimes it doesn't trade. That's why the best indicator in terms of potential premium you have to pay and also the subprime mortgage-backed security price is ABS index.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any sense of the relative volume of total ABX done versus single names done in the market? Did you ever try to estimate that for any reason?
What is the total market volume? No, we wanted to get a sense what's the volume, but it's difficult because nobody's tracking this, and you know, all the major broker dealers were involved, so no one's really tracking this, and it's almost impossible to track this. You can trade with one dealer and you unwind with another dealer. So,
well, what was your sense of it, of the volume, and also of of who was in what kind of a position?
Well, the volume I would estimate probably hundreds of billions of CDS.
And when?
In 2007. Who's in what position? We don't know.
Would you? Your guess is that the highest volume was in 07 rather than in 06.
I think so because in 06 prices were relatively stable. It did drop a little bit, but it's not significant. It's really when you come to 07 with all those events I just described, the rating downgrades, the collapse of two Bear Stearns hedge funds, the bankruptcy of New Century, and also several other subprime originators, and HSBC News, I think that has caused the market to realize the risk in the credit market, in the housing market, in the subprime market.
Did you approach anyone for either a swap or a CDO product who said no to you?
Did anyone
say no to you? It's a little bit difficult for him to answer, I think, because they definitely had, they had discussions with so many different counterparties, and sometimes those discussions went nowhere, and sometimes they actually resulted in something So I don't know that people necessarily said no to UC Han as much as things just not reaching the finish line.
Right. Well, you know, we've had discussions with many counterparties. We'd like to buy protection on these mortgage-backed securities, so sometimes we can get it done, sometimes it doesn't go anywhere, so...
In order for there to be derivatives shorts available, there has to be someone who's going long.
Mm-hmm.
So, who was going long in 2007?
Well, when we were buying protection, we faced investment banks, broker dealers. And we don't know if broker-dealers hedged their risk or they just took it on to their balance sheet. That's something we don't know. And also, we don't really care if they hedge it or they have it with themselves. So we don't know if... So we actually don't know who's their counterparty. We know who we face. We don't know who they face. We don't know who the broker-dealers face.
Well, by when would you have to have been crazy to not hedge it?
Not to hedge? Oh, you mean the broker-dealers should have hedged their risk?
Yeah.
They probably should, but, you know, it's
she
their business
saying,
decision.
By when, do you have any, huh? She was saying, by when would you have had to be crazy not to hedge it?
By when?
Like
by
a month
when?
Or a year.
In other words,
oh.
6 or 7.
When?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you have all these issues with HSBC and New Century, it probably makes sense to start to really hedge your risk in this sector. But I think it's really a judgment call, right? I know some people put on their short trade in February 2007, March 2007, but then they later on they unwind their trade. So you have people in and out of the market.
This is a bit more sort of stepping back and looking at market developments and how they might have impacted each other. We, in summer of 2005, pay-as-you-go swaps, single names, are introduced. A few leaders, like Paulson, take the short position. Do you have a sense of whether, do you have an opinion as to whether the development of that ability to go short ended up leading to more subprime mortgage credit creation because people could then hedge? Have you thought about that?
Well, you know, front, it's, you have more subprime mortgage credit creation, you can argue because now people have an instrument to short, but at the same time, back then, it's actually because the reason we had synthetic subprime CDS was because there's huge demand for this type of assets from a long standpoint. A lot of investors would like to go long mortgage-backed securities, but there were not enough assets, cash assets, for them to go long, so they had to go to the synthetic market to sell protection to get exposure to this type of assets.
Therefore, in other words, your thinking is more that the creation of the synthetic instruments helped satisfy the overwhelming demand.
Yes.
A different perspective, which you may not agree with, is that the developments in derivatives also led to just more trading in general, and some people going short one tranche and long another, and therefore led to greater activity and perhaps demand for certain instruments, because they could then, you know, there would be demand to go long, because it was all about a bet of relative performance. Mm-hmm. Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, for some investors, they need to hedge their credit risk. For money managers, their assets are from pension funds and endowments. They need to protect their investor capital. With subprime CDS, they're able to hedge their credit risk or their market risk with the CDS instruments. So it helps to protect the investor capital. There are companies, hedge funds, or money managers that went long and short. I think back then it probably was a valid strategy, but it's just they probably they didn't really estimate the loss ratio correctly. The losses were so high, it was able to wipe out almost everything, all the way to even AAA. So.
I asked this before about, did any of the developments surprise you? You said, in essence, not really, because we had a negative view of the market. But did the extent of the deterioration surprise you, or was that, you know, actually consistent with some of your views that the market would go down, you know, 40% or more?
It's home price decline was pretty consistent with our view, because we would expect home prices to return to its historical average average trend, long-term trend. So if you look at today's home price, it's dropped about, from peak to trough, it's dropped about 32% according to Case-Shiller Index. And if you use that to complete our trend line, that's 32%. Now home prices are actually back to its historical trend line. So in that respect, in that aspect, it does not surprise us at all. We had expected home price to correct. We had expected home price to come back to its historical trend line. And I think the reason I said we were not so surprised was mainly because from the beginning we were concerned not just with the housing market, but with leverage in general. The problem we had is really the leverage. In homeowners, mortgage borrowers took too much leverage. A lot of loans, about 20% of subprime mortgages were 100% financing. So there is it's almost infinite leverage there. And same with all the financial institutions. They took too much leverage. All the banks took 30 times leverage. So if you have 3% decline in your assets, your equity is going to be wiped out. So the reason I say it's not surprising to us is really because we were concerned about leverage from the beginning. And too much leverage is going to create all these problems.
Other than homeowners and financial institutions, were there other aspects of too much leverage in the system that concerned you?
I think it's really homeowners and financial institutions. Just that's why we are still seeing deleveraging today. Banks are deleveraging, homeowners, consumers are deleveraging.
What about investors being able to place highly levered bets?
That too. I think it's just that's probably those two hedge funds at Bear Stearns are probably the best example. They buy these ABS CDOs, AAA rated ABS CDOs, to earn LIBOR plus 100 basis points. So they had to take 12 times leverage to bring that to 12% hedge fund return. And it's just too much leverage, especially with those risky and complex ABS CDO products.
We had talked before, and I've wrongly asked about collateral and leverage, because this really doesn't apply on the short side. It does apply on the long side. So on the long side, was part of your concern about leverage actually the development of, like, did you focus on this? If you didn't, it's quite fine. I'm just trying to explore some of the derivatives questions that with collateral requirements being limited, that actually derivatives allowed for more leveraged investing, perhaps, than without derivatives. So was that part of your view of the world and developments in the financial system?
Yeah, our view is just, you know, it's too much leverage in the whole system. If you look at the overall leverage in the U.S. economy, non-financial corporations plus household plus government debt is about 350% of the GDP, and historical average is probably around 200%. The whole system has taken too much leverage, and the leverage is especially high in the consumer sector and also in the financial sector. And that has caused the financial crisis.
Since you've said that, are there other causes of the financial crisis that you'd like to enumerate?
There are definitely other causes, but I think leverage is, if I have to talk about the number one cause, I have to put leverage as the number one cause. There are other reasons why we had the whole subprime and credit crisis. Yes, investment banks were pretty aggressive in doing all the deals to push all these products to investors. And you have predatory lending in the origination market. Underwriting standards deteriorated so much in the market. Subprime mortgages back in 1996 was only 1% of the entire mortgage market. But when you come to 2006, it becomes 15% of the entire mortgage market. So one out of seven mortgage borrowers in the country is a subprime mortgage borrower. So rating agencies got pressure from banks to give out ratings. You know, I think it's a mistake many investors made, just like the rating agency. You know, rating agencies were relying too much on historical data to come up with their rating models, but at the same time, there is this sort of conflict of interest there. They got paid from investment banks, so they got kind of received a lot of pressure to complete deals for investment banks. So there are many reasons for the financial crisis, but the number one cause is leverage. If we hadn't had so much leverage, then we wouldn't have, if all the subprime mortgage borrowers were required to put down 30% or even 40%, then the delinquency rate today probably going to be pretty low. If banks were not able to take 30 times leverage, if they were able to take only 10 times leverage, I don't think Bear Stearns is going to fail. I don't think Lehman's going to fail.
I'm going to pause. Sorry, before we do, I neglected to ask for your consent on the record for our taping the interview. So do you consent?
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you. All right, so we're back after a break, and I've turned the tape recorder back on. I wonder if we could go back to the three different strategies that you talked about and walk through some of the mechanics of executing on each of those strategies. Who called whom? Who showed what to whom? What meetings? You know, you had in developing the execution of those strategies.
You know, for ABX, it's pretty standard. We get quotes from dealers throughout the day, so if we want to buy protection, we can just call dealers and ask if they how much liquidity they have, how much they can do. And we can compare price between dealers. For single name CDS, it's pretty much the process I described, the auction process I described. We send out an offer wanted in competition, and then to get bids back from dealers. Sometimes we also participate in so-called B week. So that's when you have someone that want to sell protection, and they're going to send out bids wanted in competition, B week. And then we can participate through a broker dealer, putting our bids, how much we'd like to pay for that particular name. So these are two different ways to do single name CDS, B week and O week. For ABS CDOs, we ask broker dealer to see if they have anything to offer to us for ABS CDOs, and then they can tell us what deals they have liquidity, and we can buy protection on those.
So there have been some reported stories of meetings between Paulson Co. and different dealers about, you know, creating CDOs. So could you talk about your knowledge of that?
Well, we have expressed our view in terms of our negative view on the housing market and on the subprime market. So most of the broker dealers know this is our view. We want to go short the market through CDS, both ABS CDOs and also single name CDS and also ABFs. So we got, I think we got contacted by some dealers to suggest we can go short ABS CDOs. So as I described earlier, in some cases we figure out what are the deals they have protection to offer in the secondary market, and in a few other cases we basically bought protection on a newly issued CDO.
So could you talk about that process?
Yes. So for newly created CDO, it's basically they will have the counterparty will sell us protection on the CDO, and then we basically are going to suggest some names to them. These are the collateral we'd like to have in to be included in the ABS CDO, and the counterparty will finalize what other names to be included, and then we come with a price we would like to pay, the protection premium we pay on the ABS CDO, and then we do the transaction.
So you would, if it's the creation of a new CDO, then you are actually taking the short position versus single names rather than taking a short position on a CDO tranche. Is that correct?
No. For ABS CDOs, we're taking the short position directly on the CDO, on the CDO tranche. But the CDO itself is backed by subprime mortgage-backed securities.
So you could actually do either of the strategies you were just posing. So either short all the names in a CDO, or you could short the tranche of the CDO.
Thank you. I do understand that. But you were speaking a minute ago about new origination of CDOs.
That's right.
So in that context, which of these two strategies were you taking?
When we buy protection on newly created ABS CDOs, we're buying protection on the CDO tranche directly.
And was your buying protection important to the underwriter in executing the newly created CDO?
In every synthetic CDO, you have someone that wants to sell protection. You also have someone that wants to buy protection. So yes, you need to have both sides to create the CDO.
That's true on the underlying single name collateral. To my understanding, and if I'm incorrect, please correct me, but that's not true with regard to the CDO tranches. To create a CDO, you only need long investors in the CDO.
If it's cash assets, you only need long investors in the CDO. If it's a synthetic CDO, synthetic CDO means it's not, it's just a, it's a CDS contract. So CDO investors in a synthetic CDO usually are referring to long investors, and they are protection sellers. And so you also need someone to sell protection on the other side. And you also need someone to sell, to buy protection on the other side. So you have synthetic CDO investors that are selling protection. So if they're selling protection, where do they get the get their coupon from? They need to get their coupon from someone, because it's synthetic, it's not cash, see, it's, it doesn't have cash assets. So they need to get their coupon from someone that's going to buy protection. So for the synthetic CDO, you need, it's there is no difference between a synthetic CDO and a synthetic single name CDS.
Generally the short positions, to my understanding, in a CDO are essentially all single name shorts and are not shorts on a CDO tranche. So I agree with you that you need shorts in order to create the CDO, what synthetic CDO, but my understanding had been that it's shorts of single names, and you have no need for a short on a CDO tranche in order to create a synthetic CDO, unless it is part of some more sophisticated trading strategy that is broader than just the creation of the CDO.
No, I think you are correct. We're actually both correct. We're talking about two different things. What you're referring to is the creation, the traditional way of creating a synthetic CDO. So you have investor that are willing to buy protection on the underlying assets, and then they got translated into the CDO. So you have investors on the other side to buy the CDO, basically they're selling protection on all the underlying assets, which you already have someone to pay protection premium from.
Right.
This is the traditional way you just described, which is correct. What I just described is a different way, which is also correct. It's basically you don't have to buy protection on all the underlying assets. You just buy protection on, you specify attachment point and a detachment point. So you just say, I want to buy protection on a portfolio of subprime mortgage-backed securities from certain attachment point to certain detachment point. And then you find the investor that's waiting to sell you protection on that portion. So you don't need to sell protection on the entire assets. You don't have to buy protection on all the assets. You just specify attachment point and detachment point.
So in my personal semantics, I call that correlation trading rather than CDO origination. Feel free to argue with that, but would you call, there's the I would only call the traditional...
The first way as
CDO origination. And the second way, I would tend to call correlation trading. If it is not your view, if your view of the market is that's not the right semantics, then please say what you think of the right semantics.
I think it's a terminology issue. From our standpoint, we are buying protection on an ABS CDO. We are the protection buyer on that ABS CDO. So whether it's correlation trading or it's creating a CDO, it's not, it doesn't really matter to us.
Can I ask a...
Please.
Kim, can I ask? You're the analyst, but I want to posit something. If that's the case, that my simplistic here, non-economist understanding of these issues, non-finance person, that the synthetic CDO requires the two sides. Would it not be useful to look at growth in synthetic CDOs versus growth in traditional CDOs as a measure of how many people were shorting, or how big was the market for people shorting?
She was wondering if you could compare the notional value of, I guess, traditional CDOs versus synthetic CDOs, and whether that would give you some idea of the number of people shorting CDOs in the market.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good way to go to estimate the volume.
Do you happen to know that off the top of your head when it starts to look like there's a lot more people shorting by that measure?
I don't have the numbers. I can't remember. I think in terms of synthetic CDOs, it's probably going to be hundreds of billions. That number is actually, you can get it from any of the investment banks. They track these numbers very closely. But one caveat is that even for cash CDOs, some of them are going to have a synthetic bucket. So, you can have a cash CDO, it's defined as cash CDO, but it's not all cash assets. They don't have 20% assets there that are synthetic. So when you count what is the total volume of people going short or going long these ABS, CDS products, you have to count that synthetic bucket. But I don't know if banks actually are able to track this, because it's... most of the CDOs are private deals, so there is no public information you can get.
Okay.
Can I
ask one last one here?
I want to continue on that point for a minute, and then you certainly may. but the measure of synthetic CDOs, the measure of synthetic assets in cash CDOs, still would not cover ABX that did not end up in a CDO,
exactly.
Nor single name exposure
exactly.
that did not end up in a CDO.
That's correct.
So do you actually have a sense of whether most single name exposure ended up in a CDO?
We actually don't know. We don't know if they ended up in a CDO or if they just ended up somewhere else. We don't know.
And do you have any sense of whether much of the ABX long ended up in CDOs?
I don't know. I think, I'm not sure actually. Maybe some of them ended up in CDOs.
Okay.
We don't know.
All right, but Milana, please, you had another question?
So this kind of takes you back in time. It's sort of a general one. I mean, you're obviously an extremely wise person, but I wonder, why do you think you were one of so few in 2004, or is it 5 when you get hired away from Lehman? I mean, why are you the only guy? Is it because of buy-side influence, or what? Or is it because you're the only genius?
Well, you know, we use the same information as everybody else. Our data source is no different than other investors in the market. You know, I think it's just we have been able to look at this differently than other investors.
But it doesn't seem that hugely complicated. I mean, are there institutional pressures at work on other analysts?
Well, Sihan, maybe one thing you can talk about is how a lot of these other institutions, their modeling was very hinged to historical data.
Yeah, I think that's one of the issues with a lot of investors. It's, you know, a lot of these prepayment default models are basically regressions, so you have to rely on historical data. But in the U.S., there had never been a nationwide home price decline before 2006, so it's difficult to accurately model what's going to happen if you only rely on historical data. It was a bubble in the housing market. I think the definition of a bubble is just most people don't realize it's a bubble, otherwise it's not going to be a bubble.
Could we talk for a minute about the operation of the derivatives markets? You certainly said that ABX was more liquid and you could get daily pricing. Mm-hmm. Was that true throughout 07 and throughout 08 that you could still get daily pricing and that liquidity continued in ABX?
Yes, ABX has always been liquid. It's daily pricing. It's not even daily. It's really throughout the day you get price quotes from all the major broker dealers.
And did you have concerns over pricing and liquidity of single name or of CDS on CDOs? That is, did those mechanisms work as well? Operationally?
No. Obviously, they don't. It's not as pricing on single name CDS and ABS CDOs was not as transparent as ABFs because it's difficult to know where they are trading. You have thousands of these subprime mortgage-backed securities, and on any given day, you're not going to have all these names trading in the market. So you can only make some comparison analysis to look at a comparable name where it has traded in the market to estimate, to do the valuation work on ABS, CDS, single name CDS, and also ABS CDOs.
And at any points in time during the crisis or leading up to the crisis, did you have concerns about the marks that you thought they were inappropriate, unfair, inaccurate?
There are instances we have noticed prices are different on the same security from different dealers. I don't know if it's inaccurate, maybe just people using different comparison points, but it is not as good as ABFs.
Can you give an example of that, a real-world example?
I can't remember the exact name, but as I said, there are times we noticed for the same single-name CDS, we get different pricing from different broker-dealers.
Did you ever have concerns about any market manipulation of ABCDX, CDS?
Yes, we had concerns. Our concern was you have investment banks that is doing underwriting, originating all these loans and underwriting all the securitization deals, and they also controlled the servicer. So they have a lot of information about these deals, which most investors do not have. And they can do, with the controlled servicing, they can do certain things which investors probably don't want them to do. And on the other hand, they also have CDS trading. So if they have some certain information, or if they can direct servicers to do certain things, then there is sort of this issue with potential market manipulation.
What is an example of certain things that they could be asked to do that the investors didn't want them to do?
Well, for example, if they just modify these mortgages to bring down the delinquency rate, even though it's not qualified modification.
I'm sorry, but I couldn't hear the audio there. I had this weird glitch there. Would you mind going back and saying what you just said again? I couldn't hear your answer.
Sure. If the servicer is doing modification, which is not justified, which is not a qualified modification, by doing so, they can bring down the delinquency rate. And the deal is going to appear to perform better than expected. That's going to help the deal pricing.
Did you ever notice this and do something about it?
Well, we had the concern. We never noticed anything, but that's the concern we had.
I don't understand.
Well, Paulson had worries that this could happen, that that the underlying pool might be changed without them, and be changed from what they originally invested in. So they did have concerns about it, and they actually did talk to the SEC about that concern. But I don't know that they ever knew what was happening anywhere. You know, they just were worried that it could happen.
And are you knowledgeable about the SEC's reaction to that?
I think the SEC had a sympathetic ear and said they were certainly open to, talking more about that. But I don't think anything, and, you know, I think these talks happened at the same time the economy was going crazy. And so then by the time sort of 2007, 2008 unfolded, it was just not so much an issue anymore. The whole market had gone away.
Yeah, I think the trade had played itself out by that point, so there was never really any follow-up that needed to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
But it was on a specific trade that Mr. Xu, you had concerns?
No, it's not on any specific trade. It's just a general concern we had.
What year would that have been?
That was
07.
07, yeah.
Okay. Kimmy, can I ask one last one? And there's people who want me to free up this room for something else.
Sure.
Earlier, I was asking about good brand names for lousy CDOs. I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit about Countrywide.
Countrywide? I think they're fine. I think they, it's just like other originators. They've originated quite a lot of subprime mortgages, and they have taken losses on those mortgages.
Well, did you deal in the Countrywide product?
You know, we bought protection on a variety of originators and servicers, so I'm sure that probably also includes Countrywide.
Okay, thanks very much. I'm sorry to jump off now. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Milana. I only have a few more. Did you ever go short using Tabex?
No, we didn't. There is no liquidity there.
Okay. Were you ever surprised by the price trends in Tabex?
No, since we were not involved in Tabex, we didn't really pay close attention to that. We didn't notice, we didn't follow the price movement there.
Okay. Did you do triggerless CDOs?
Maybe. You know, we've done several. We bought potential on several ABS CDOs. I think some of them are triggerless.
Were you at the time aware of Magnetar's activity in the CDO market?
We heard about it, but you know, we didn't know much about it. We heard about Magnetar as a CDO manager, bringing a lot of CDOs to the market. That's what we knew at the time.
I don't think they were a manager. I think they were just going long and short certain tranches.
Yeah. Now we know that's what they did, but back then we thought they were a CDO manager, bringing a lot of deals to the market. They were investing in the equity tranche. That's what we heard about.
Did you invest in the equity tranche of any CDOs?
Yes, we did.
As a long or as a short?
It's really as a way to offset our net carry. Since we bought protection on ABS CDOs, and also bought protection on a lot of these CDS and ABFs, we used this investment in equity tranche as a way to offset the negative carry. If things go well with housing market, subprime market, then these ABS CDO equity is going to really pay off. The return was pretty attractive on these equity tranches. But if it didn't go well, we would lose money on ABS CDO equity tranche, but we've made money. We've have made money on the other positions. So
this was relatively early on, as well. This equity trade that he's talking about.
And were those in static or managed deals?
Those are all in static deals.
So, sorry, just to restate to make sure I have it correctly, when you bought the times in which Paulson bought equity. As a long in CDOs, they were all four static CDOs.
They're all in static CDOs, yes.
And Stuart, you think that was more 06 or 05?
Yeah, it's 05, 06, yeah.
And why did you change your strategy and stop doing that?
Well, you know, as the market started to deteriorate, it's just we realized it's just it's better for us just to have a directional trade rather than
you gained more confidence in your negative views.
That's right.
In other words,
mm-hmm.
Fair enough. Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
No, I think. You've pretty much covered everything.
Thank you very much for your time.